Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 39, and we're going to meet one of the country's most incredible characters whose activities on the frontier in the late 1700s were to be forgotten, buried away. Coenraad de Beys was probably one of the most African of all Trek Boers, as you're going to hear, and the saga of his life was written out of textbooks long before apartheid. That was because he married Khoi and Xhosa women and lived amongst both people quite comfortably. At the same time, he was still a Trek Boer, as you'll hear. He was also the original rebel and ex-soldier who was nearly 7 feet tall. Coenraad de Beys is the most legendary, rougher, dominating and ruthless of all rebels. His presence on the frontier of the Cape Colony dominated 20 years of Southern African history, and he was also, as I said last episode, a symbol of a lost root of Afrikaner history. In the gallery of traditional Afrikaner heroes, de Beys has no place. He is merely a footnote in most writings, including modern revisionist texts, because he fits neither the race-obsessed romantic colonial historian nor the race-obsessed pan-Africanist historian of the 21st century. Once you've heard his tale, you'll agree that someone should consider a Netflix special. He provides a magnificent illustration, as writer Noel Mostad points out. He was an embarrassment to the Cape authorities. Then, long after his death, white nationalists tried hard to forget he ever existed. Black nationalists also have a big problem with this big Dutch soldier. He was the embodiment of all that was different and interchangeable on the early South African frontier. On the one hand, he represents interracial intimacy that shocks many who have never heard of Coenraad de Beys. On the other, he was ruthlessly self-interested and brutal when it came to how he dealt with his enemies, both black and white. He treated women particularly badly. Traveller Henry Lichtenstein met him and offered the best-known written description we have of de Beys. His uncommon height, for he measured nearly 7 feet, the strength yet admirable proportion of his limbs, his excellent carriage, the confident look in his eye, his high forehead, his whole mien, and a certain dignity in his movements, made altogether a more pleasing impression. Such one might conceive to have been the heroes of ancient times. He seemed to be the living figure of Hercules, the terror of his enemies, the hope and support of his friends. So that is a tad gushing, granted. Born in 1761, he was in his 20s when he began to appear in the record on his farm in the Zierveld. He lived near Bushman's River and was the descendant of a French Huguenot, Jean de Beys, who just over 100 years before had landed as a refugee in the Cape. The Huguenots, as we know, were industrious people satisfied with little and had brought the Cape the first European bourgeois stability, and as we've also heard, they also advanced social skills, animal husbandry, and moral high-mindedness. The family eventually rolled away from the vineyards and oaks of Stellenbosch, heading eastwards like so many other Trek Boers. Later, his father would have been shocked at the man who inherited a bourgeois way of life and would dress in animal skins like the Khoi and Xhosa, more at home in a hut than a house, more familiar with the temper of a bull elephant than with a church or a school. Coenraad de Beys never married a white woman, although he had several wives and many concubines. He was not a nice man. He took women by force when they refused his advances. So in many ways, he symbolized the Trek Boer on the veld, seizing what they wanted, and yet, in other ways, he didn't. His wives and women were often mixed race, as well as Khoi Khoi or isiXhosa. Among them was the large and corpulent mother of Nika, whom he served as a counselor and chief advisor to the young man. De Beys also left a large clan of mixed race South Africans, and later, in the 1820s, would move with them towards the last wilderness in the country, the Northern Transvaal. To this day, his descendants live in what is now Limpopo province. On their farms, once classified during apartheid as non-white, or the Beys folk, the Beys nation. During the last two decades of the 18th century, the Cape authorities regarded him as a loose cannon, dangerous and highly influential. He was part of the cause of the Second Frontier War, as you're going to hear, as much as the Prinsloos were part of the first. The Trek Boers believed in him so much that they wanted him as the leader of their proposed republic on the frontier. Of course, the fact that he had black wives in those days did not faze these Boers one little bit. Later, he would be at Inika's ear, pressing the Xhosa chief to join the Trek Boers in a concerted drive to rid South Africa of the English. His time spent as advisor to Inika's mother is probably the most remarkable. His leadership characteristics were obvious to both Boer and Xhosa, and he spoke Xhosa fluently from an early age, along with the Khoi language. Much later, when he lived in the vicinity of the Orange River, he led San and mixed-race people against the missionaries that arrived, claiming they'd weaken indigenous knowledge. He is the very essence of what being a Trek Boer was. He trekked and hunted assiduously, marking out the interior for possession, and always adapting his ways to the local way of life. The base was also mistrustful of other settlers, and rebelled against all established authority, and fomented discord recklessly at times. Coenraad de Base was a wild, cunning, sly, brutal, and ambiguous figure, but represented a significant early social presence in southern Africa. In Mozambique, the Portuguese explorers were more like de Base. They carved out huge estates for themselves in the interior and then became absorbed into the indigenous population by taking black wives and concubines. There was so much in the Trek Boer way of life that was inconsistent and strange, and a contradiction of what many historians report. This period of southern African history was not where the real mold of apartheid appeared. The narrow racial perspectives of later Transvaal Boers and nationalist Afrikaner politicians. They painted these early Boers as alone on the veldt, whereas they weren't. They were having relationships with black people. By the account of these politically biased 19th and 20th century politicians, the white frontiersman was implacably hostile to the blacks he confronted and guided only by his belief in pigmentary superiority, separate destiny, and the mastership of God's elect on the land. While this attitude did harden and develop later, right now things were more variable. As historian Martin Legasic has proven, the early frontiersmen did not view Xhosa men and women as simply servants, and they were also not regarded implacably as enemies. Remember, when de Base and the other Trek Boers bumped into the Xhosa, both sides were riven by internal competition. Xhosa power had been fractured by the sons of Paulo fighting over their bloodline, Rarabi Ngqika. Rarabi offered an alliance with the Boers against other Xhosa in the First Frontier War. That was not the last time the Frontier Wars would combine settler and Xhosa together in joint military ventures. Many radical politicians these days would prefer not to tackle this thorny issue and merely dismiss it as selling out. That's laughably disinformed and implies a kind of mental illness. It's so bluntly inaccurate. The fact is, early Boers adapted easily to Xhosa life, so similar as it was to their own on the veldt. None was strange. Foreign visitors recoiled at the flies, the dark clouds of smoke around the kraal and the huts, but these things were very similar to the Trek Boers' early homes. Skin colour was not their problem. They took black concubines as they had taken Khoi Khoi concubines, and even wives. They took up residence inside Xhosa kraals under the authority of the chiefs. However, apart from Coenraad de Base and a handful of other Trek Boers, this common lifestyle did not lead to Boers marrying Isikhoza women in a traditional sense, as in ritually, with all the trappings and blessings by a dominee to move to their own umizi on a hill nearby. Yes, proximity and intimacy achieved familiarity, sensual gratification, and a shared lifestyle of mutual convenience, but not full understanding. For example, explorer Liechtenstein traveled about the Zuurveld in the 1780s and noted that in 1786, the company administration had arrived just in time to save these frontier colonials who were going native, so to speak. The VOC set up the administration in the village of Graaf Reinet, named after the governor of the day and his family. It was at the base of the Sneeuwberg, just north of Brenkieshoogte. Graaf Reinet is on the banks of the Sundays River. Its source is in the peaks above, and it flows down to Algoa Bay. Authority in Graaf Reinet was represented by Landros, a magistrate whose seat was called Drosti, and the building was residence, office, court, and military headquarters. Most in the Cape believed this little Drosti came 20 years too late. The Prinsloos, de Bases, and others had abused the freedom of the frontier for decades. Liechtenstein was to write that the assembling together of so many uncultivated men in so remote a country, where everyone without any attention to the laws acted only according to his own pleasure, could not fail of producing bad effects upon the general character. They were individuals and acted as kings in their own fiefdoms, and Liechtenstein was shocked. Graaf Reinet was a hopelessly inadequate civil authority. The Landrost had four or five mounted policemen to try and oversee several hundred colonists who were, as Liechtenstein notes, some of the most fractious and turbulent of the whole colony. Of course, we've heard what happened when the Landrost needed help. He merely called out the commander. The French, meanwhile, had been spending some time in the Cape ensuring the English didn't take the port for themselves, and Cape Town took to calling itself Little Paris, somewhat grandiosely. This further lengthened the cultural difference between the frontier and genteel Europeanized Cape Town. It had taken decades for some sort of local authority to arrive in the frontier, and now that it had, many who had asked for military support were having second thoughts. The Trekboers conducted their illegal trade with the frontier Xhosa despite the new Landrost, and then refused to join commandos when called. The First Frontier War had ended in 1781 with the belief that Adriaan van der Asvelt, who we met last episode, had expelled the Qunuqwebe and Mbalu from the Zuurveld. But these people merely moved back through the 1780s. And in fact, it was doubtful that Chaka's Qunuqwebe had ever left. They just moved away from the commando led by van der Asvelt, then returned almost immediately after it disbanded. The Qunuqwebe believed they had a right to the territory, and at this point, Mother Nature conspired to increase resource pressure. A major drought took place in the mid-1780s, and many more Xhosa began appearing in the Zuurveld pastures. In 1789, for example, one description by an explorer spoke of 16,000 cattle on one farm alone, inhabited by several thousand Xhosa people. But the Xhosa weren't making matters easier for themselves either. The Qunuqwebe were still being harassed and raided by Ntlambe's Rarabe warriors. Ntlambe was trying to subjugate both the Qunuqwebe and Mbalu and practiced a classic divide-and-rule strategy. He used one against the other. Langa's Mbalu were the useful tool against the Qunuqwebe, whom he defeated eventually. This, once again, led to the defeated Xhosa clan falling back westward straight into the Trekboers of the Zuurveld. The Qunuqwebe were impoverished and sought cattle and food. Stock theft increased, and Coenraad de Beys and other frontier Boers believed they could then retrieve their cattle by raiding the Xhosa in turn. The various Landrosts and Graaf Reinet tried to preach caution over the years. The Boers began taking matters into their own hands from the end of the 1780s and into the early 1790s. The Qunuqwebe and Mbalu now found they had more in common as the Trekboers sallied forth capturing cattle from whomever they pleased. Chief Langa of the Mbalu, who dabbled with the settlers in the past, now began to peer more maliciously at the Trekboer farms. And the shootings of Amakosa men accused of trespassing increased, only serving to increase the tension. Coenraad de Beys was at the forefront of all this, and he was marked by the Zuurveld Xhosa as a principal instigator and originator of their trials and difficulties. Some of the acts he committed are not just brutal, they imply he was a psychopath. He took cattle when and where he fancied, and in one incident, when Xhosa men at kraals complained, he made them lie on the ground and then whipped them almost to death. He seized Xhosa women as concubines and ordered his khoikhoi servants to shoot any man who complained. Several were shot this way. Then, just to reinforce his power, de Beys arrived at Langa's great place and seized one of the Xhosa chief's wives, whom he promptly pressed into service as his concubine. That infuriated Langa. Then later, the Mbalu chief was on a hunting expedition and stopped by at a Boer farm. The normal order of things was that as a chief he would be treated hospitably, fed, and allowed on his way. Instead, he was locked up in the house, his assegais were taken away, and then he was told he had to barter his travelled cattle. Basically, they were stolen from him. In another incident, one of the infamous Badenhoats locked up Chungwa, the son of Qunuqwebe chief Chaka, in the farm mill and then ordered this son to turn the mill instead of using a mule or an ox. These insulting events were increasing in frequency, and eventually both the settlers and the Amakosa had had enough of each other. These unheard-of insults and aggression against the Xhosa chiefs and their heirs were not going to continue without some sort of explosion or revenge. For a man like Langa, son of Paulo and brother of the great Rarabe himself, the assault against his person and his royal lineage was unprecedented. Langa also paid for his alliance with Xhosa King Ntlambe, who lived east of the fish, because the Qunuqwebe realized he was now in a weak position and began to prey on him as well. As the 1780s wore to an end, the Zuurveld was moving towards war, and on two levels, Xhosa versus Xhosa and colonists versus Xhosa. As the colonists were to discover, the Xhosa now were a very different people from those they'd faced in the first frontier war 10 years before. This time, they would be armed and they would also be riding horses. Although white hunters had been traveling through the Xhosa from the beginning of the 1700s, it was only by the late 1780s that they had built up knowledge and skill in both firearms and horse riding. Some Zierveld Xhosa were now experts in the use of both. A steady trickle of former Boer Khoi Khoi servants seeking sanctuary amongst the Kunukwebe started this new phenomenon. Horsemanship and marksmanship improved through the decade between the First Frontier War and the Second. A second marked change had taken place when it came to the conduct of war itself. The Xhosa had noted Van Jaarsveld's tobacco ambush trick. Usually, the Xhosa way of war was that both sides would settle on the time and the day and the place. Then there was a formal process leading to the clash. Instead, Van Jaarsveld's scattering of tobacco, as you heard last episode, changed that. From now on, it would be ambush and subterfuge, as the Trek Boers could not be trusted to stick to the Xhosa rules of war, so the chiefs began to deploy the settler way, trick or treat. As for the Trek Boers, the last 20 years to 1789 had been characterized by their own set of changes. The African veld was a different place. They were attacked by the San and the Sneeuwbach. Tragedy and disillusion had grown. The Zuurveld now offered something even more menacing. The Trek Boers' constant fear was being overwhelmed by hordes of angry Xhosa and San. In turn, they reacted overly aggressively, trying to prove they were tougher. Ironically, this brutality backfired because they were doing it in a non-collective way without caution as individual rebel Dutch, thereby exposing each other to more violence. When the Sneeuwbach Boers had asked the Zuurveld Boers for help against the San, they refused, saying that Xhosa were more dangerous. The Zuurveld Boers were practicing communal dispersion, which was their habit after moving beyond the Cape. Their farms were strung out, scattered, lonely and isolated, marking them out as they ventured deeper into Xhosa territory, beyond even the Fish River. When the Trek Boers flogged their workers for whatever reason, these Xhosa men would leave and complain to the chief, who'd then hold a meeting, usually leading to a group of warriors heading back to the farm to raid cattle as punishment. Most of the factors that shaped frontier relationships manifested themselves in the life of Chungwa, chief of the Kunukwebe, between 1793 and 1812. In the 1780s, Chungwa and his father were firmly established in the area between the Fish and Sundays rivers. They wanted nothing more than a quiet life and to placate the colony. This included agreeing to purchase the land they were already living on, or rent it on the same terms as the Boers. The Kunukwebe also helped the Boers against the San in the north around Prenkieshoogte, as the Xhosa had done for the Khoi decades before. The Kunukwebe were largely Khoi themselves historically, so they naturally attracted Khoi farm runaways and slaves. By 1790, there were regular meetings between colonial officials and Chaka and Chungwa in an attempt to prevent a war. That helped to reduce tension until the disastrous commander, led by Lindeke, in 1793, provoked the Kunukwebe and Mbaulu to settle old scores with the colonists. Chaka's Kunukwebe could not move to the east bank of the Fish River because of old scores with the Xhosa to the east. Chaka dared not go back over the Great Fish River. He'd be at Ntlambe's mercy. The Boers of the Zuurveld were growing uneasy, their slaves and Khoi Khoi servants deserting to the Amaxhosa of the Zuurveld, taking with them their skills as musketeers and horsemen, and a desire to seek revenge against their former masters. To unsettle matters further, Lunga of the Mbalu cleverly allied himself with Ntlambe, and both chiefs began eyeing the pasture treasures of the Zuurveld as well. That meant they harassed both the Amakunukwebe and the Trek Boers. What a messy situation. So the war was brewing. In 1792, Ntlambe launched a campaign to compel all Xhosa chiefdoms west of the Great Fish to come back across the river and to place themselves directly under his rule. Rather than do that, the Amakunukwebe fled further west into the Zuurveld once again, overrunning settler farms. The Zuurveld Boers were aware of what had triggered this exodus, but were boiling with indignation at the reluctance of the Cape to do anything about it. This is where Field Cornet Barend Lindeke comes into the equation. He decided it was time for a little bit of vigilante commando action. Without the government's knowledge, Lindeku approached Nhlambe with the objective of forming an alliance against the Zuurveld Amaxhosa. Both wanted these people out. Nhlambe was very pleased to hear of this, in the same way that Rarabe had cooperated with the Boers more than a decade before. It was the perfect opportunity to shatter his old foes, the Amaqunukwebe, once and for all, and to bring Langa's Mbalu to heel at the same time. As you're going to hear in next episode, the Drek Boers completely miscalculated, and hundreds of Boer homesteads would be torched. Tens of thousands of head of their cattle would be driven off, and most of the Boers then abandoned the Zuurveld completely for a while. A propensity to seek violence as a quick solution to a crisis often backfires, and this was a case in point. We suddenly, the Drek Boers realized they had invited thousands of Nhlambe's Amaxhosa warriors across the Fish River and panicked at the sight. Most of these farmers, of course, couldn't tell one Xhosa clan apart from another. So with that, we'll end for this week. Please rate the podcast on iTunes. It helps elevate the story on Apple's hegemonic dominions. Little editorializing there. If you want to contact me, you can email through my website, desmondlatham.com, or direct message me on Twitter, @DesLatham. Until next, goodbye.